Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company.
This week on Meat and Three, we get ready for Super Tuesday by looking at how food shapes elections both at home and abroad.
People know that you don't order a Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese as John Kerry did back in the 2004 cycle.
A young group of friends decided that they would put up a website which told voters which polling booths had sausages.
Prime Minister David Cameron was pictured about a week after this incident eating a hot dog in a bun with a knife and fork because he was so afraid.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts. Good morning. Today is Thursday, March 5th. This is the Main Course OG, and I am Emily Pearson, your co-host, along with my colleague, Patrick Martins.
Well, I'm excited to be here. This is going to be a great show.
Awesome. Well, today we have in studio with us Jay Rayner. Jay is an award-winning journalist, writer, and broadcaster who is perhaps best known as restaurant critic for the UK's Observer. He also just published a very entertaining memoir about his ideal Last Supper. Jay, thanks for being with us.
It's
good morning.
It's a delight to be here. I do love your signature tune.
Thank you so much.
It's very special.
Mickey Finn is the composer.
So I feel like it's the like moments where I'm finishing like powdering my nose before someone, you know, the person on set runs off stage and we go live with the cameras.
You're not orange enough for that.
Oh,
you know
right.
What I mean? That kind of day glow makeup.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, our president is orange.
I have to say, on a couple of occasions when I've done US TV shows, I did two series of Top Chef Masters out in LA, and each time I would arrive and say to makeup, do not make me orange. And they would go, what do you mean? And I go, you know what I mean.
You know what I mean.
You know what I mean.
Well, you know, you have to like have that smooth look on TV. Here, you know. Yeah. We said take away some of the
yeah,
makeup.
Radio is very easy on the eyes.
Very easy on the eyes. So we're going to jump in with a game of word association. We do this every week. And actually this week we picked the same word for our whole group. Jay, openings and closings. More of a term.
And you want me to throw...
Initial reactions.
Just word associate. What, tell us about openings.
Openings in my life are new restaurants that have turned up and me trying to work out whether I need to pay attention. I try not to be the kind of restaurant critic who runs in when the paint is still wet. But there are some which are so keen and so exciting and so voluble, you have to be there.
Although you did say that it's fair game as soon as the soft opening, the prices go to the normal prices.
Once the prices go to the normal prices, listen, if they're going to employ the very expensive PR people to start banging PR press releases at you, telling you all about their sustainable small plate Peruvian Korean mashup dishes, and then they come off soft opening, it's fair game.
I believe that a restaurant should be solely judged on the first day of friends and family.
Do you?
I know that's a little harsh.
Patrick, are you applying to be a UK restaurant critic?
I'm just trying to get invited to friends and family.
Is that what it is? I think you've just gone about it entirely the wrong way. Nobody is inviting you to friends and family if what you're going for is to judge them.
Patrick also has this little issue called a spam filter with his email. He's like, I didn't get it. I'm like,
okay,
did you
tell us about closings.
Closings are sad. Closings are where things generally have gone wrong. And we're seeing an awful lot of them in the British restaurant scene at the moment. The economics are very, very tough. I have, as well as my restaurant column, at the end of it online, is a thing called News Bites. Obviously, Bites is spelled B-I-T-E-S. Has to be. And I've been keeping a running toll of, you know, who's closing. And every time a restaurant closes, it's not necessarily that bad for the staff, as in the waiters and the cooks, because there's an awful lot of demand for them, weirdly. But it can be terrible for the suppliers, who often end up getting
stiffed. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, as a vendor, when you learn in the fine print that you're about to not get paid.
Well, if closings is my word, too, part of closings is good riddance. You know, and here in New York, we have 200,000 restaurants. I think a third of them need to close. They can't be sourcing good ingredients. I think they're at risk of not paying their vendors anyway. And I would like to see more business drawn to the better restaurants who are buying good stuff, who have the great chef, the Union Square Cafes of the world. I mean, they're doing fine, but...
For me, it's a little nostalgia. Then I'm like... Who's going to come in and maybe, I don't know. I still lament the popover here in New York.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but that's fine.
All right, fine. It's this delightfully puffy, crispy croissant of sorts with a little eggy filling. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we're going to move on. We have our next section we call our weekly based or round robin.
It's real the meat of the matter, is this it? Section.
Okay. Yes.
I'm excited.
Good. We're ready for you, Jay. So we have, you know, about 7, 8, 9, however much you're feeling, topics for the next 20 minutes or so. So to know that a restaurant is really and truly great, we know that you don't necessarily go 3 times to this restaurant. But, you know, how do you gauge consistency? Do you order 3 different things? Do you go back? Do you go one and done? How do you, you know, sort of
gauge the breadth of the chef? How you view what your job is. And my job as a restaurant critic for a British newspaper is to tell you how much pleasure your money will buy you. Now, that does not mean that you are not also assessing whether the kitchen can cook, whether the ingredients are any good, whether the service is slick, whether they're going to say something stupid to you about their new sharing plate concept, whether the tables are big enough for all the small plates they're going to send out in any order, they, you know, all of that stuff. But my job is to tell you how much pleasure your money will bring you. And so if I'm looking at a menu, we do only go once. There are economic reasons behind that as well. You know, everybody goes on about the big beasts of American food reviewing, the like of Pete Wells on the New York Times. He's really the only one who properly moves the dial on a restaurant. The economics allow the Times to you know, soak up his expenses 3 to 5 times. There are 7, 8, 9 of us in the UK, and we're all fighting for a space, and we tend to go once. But I have to say, if dinner in a restaurant costs £80 a head, how many chances do you get?
So, and also they do the whole country, we should say.
Well, yeah. I've reviewed from Stornoway in the Scottish Islands all the way down to the Channel Islands in the south.
So can I ask if there were 100, I mean, just to put a stupid number to it, great restaurants in England, how many of those are in London and how many of those are out?
It's changed vastly. There is no doubt that London has pulled away economically in a way that is not good for the rest of the country. So when you talk about London and comparisons, those comparisons are not other cities in the UK. They are Paris, they are Tokyo, they are New York. Mm-hmm. That's how you compare London.
But are there many great restaurants around in the north, in the south, absolutely. And the east-west?
So, I mean...
I guess that has to be part of your budget, is getting there, too.
Oh, yeah, although I
It's a three-hour drive.
I don't drive, I use the train, and it can be a bit more than that. But I have a mixed economy, so I record a national panel radio show in front of a live audience, and we go all over the country. 26 times a year we do that.
That's great.
I perform live across the country probably 40 times. So there's always
in
a
your
way...
jazz that, ensemble.
The jazz ensemble, slightly less across the country than the one-man shows. That means that I'm going out to the country. And this is an interesting change. 20 years ago when I started doing the job and had a 28-inch waist, I didn't. just so we're clear.
We're not on TV, you can say whatever.
Couldn't have guaranteed that if I went anywhere in the country, I'd find somewhere worth writing about. Now, even if it requires a bit of extra effort on my part, I will be able to find somewhere that is deserving of 1,100 words on a Sunday. I can't give you the actual breakdown, but I won't say it's
here
like
in America,
85% in London. It's not like that. It's like
20%
and 80%. It's a big country.
And here in the States, in New York, it's very hard to find good chefs, for these chefs to find their sous chefs, because many have now gone into the country to small cities, and they're fantastic restaurants in Ohio,
Minneapolis,
cities, Nashville.
Yeah, people are going back to their roots.
Yeah, there is a shortage of staff. There's a shortage of skilled staff in the UK. But it's the same all over.
Yeah, same all over. So In ancient Greece, actors wore masks on stage so as not to be recognized. Do food critics do the same? Should food critics, I mean, your face is known. So, I mean, do you feel that you're ever getting unfair treatment?
Is that why you only need to go once also?
No. There are a number of things to say about this.
Do they know you're coming?
No. I book under a pseudonym. The first I know about it is when they've got me standing there.
At the coat check with your photo on the inside of the coat check door.
Like they need a photo, to be honest. So I'm a judge on MasterChef. I'm pretty well known.
Okay.
There are a number of things to be said. The first one is the myth of anonymity. So, you know, Pete Wells, who I actually had dinner with last night, is meant to be totally anonymous, and he does apparently do things to change his look. But my understanding from speaking to a bunch of people who've done that job is that within about a year, restaurant world knows what they look like. Anonymity does not last for a very long time. The second thing, and this is really key, is that restaurants are like theatre, in that everything that matters happens before I go anywhere near it. Just because I suddenly turn up at the door doesn't mean you can change your recipes, doesn't mean you can change your ingredients, your decor, the training of your staff. What can you actually do to make this look like the greatest restaurant if it's absolutely crap? Very, very little. And as one great critic said to me, you know, I'm yet to find a bad restaurant that suddenly becomes a good one because we walk through the door.
Right. But I mean, in terms of service, it could, like, the owner could be like, I'm going to take care of table one today.
Well, there are a number of things, again. I'm quite wise to that. I watch what's going on tables around
me. So can you sense inauthenticity or performance that's not real?
I can sense performance. There's often a lot of, sometimes if they're rubbish, if they're, you know, overcompensating like mad, they'll, you know, suddenly, the kitchen would like you to try this dish. I said, I didn't order it. And they went, okay. But the kitchen feels you ought to. I go, well, I'm sorry, I didn't order it, so take it back.
Right.
One of the classics is that most people, if they have a problem with a bill in a restaurant, it's because there was something on it they didn't have. Mine is always the reverse, that they tried to make the bill look cheaper. And I've spoken...
That's not fair.
It's not fair. And I've spoken
but
about
they're
this...
They're also hurting themselves. Why?
Oh, no. They think...
Not to make less money. They just want him to say it's a bargain.
They want to make it look like it's better value than it is. And I've made it so obvious now that you cannot do these things. That if you do it, you know...
Is that like a red mark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fair enough.
It should be.
So what are the real red marks that you will be mean about? Like, what are the things where you're like, this guy's going to get panned. He's going to be my 20% of articles where I pan someone.
Yeah. So the key thing we'd say is that I do not go looking for negative experiences.
Of course.
Because I don't want to have a bad meal out. And
you wouldn't be successful if you were.
Yeah. There are some big London openings where I am required to go. So, for example, your fellow American, Daniel Hum, has just opened in London at Davis and Brook, which is a sort of spin-off from 11 Madison, and I had to go. Things that are red lines are badly written menus. A really badly written menu which uses lots of adjectives that are unnecessary will drive me nuts.
Like what? Delicious?
Oh, sumptuous, nestling on a bed of moist... Well, stop it. Just tell me what the dish is. And you know.
On the flip side, though, are you okay with when menus are too vague?
I prefer...
Where you need the spiel from the server?
Well, listen...
Twice?
Now, if I need to say to them, can you just tell me a little bit more? That's fine. If the waiters don't know, then that's not fine. I have a real hatred for any front of house staff who tries to take my order without a notebook. Because that
you
just
know they're going to get it wrong.
Well, it just makes me anxious. I mean, how do I know you're Mysterioso, the magic memory man? I mean, in many ways, I like to think that I'm utterly unsuited to the job of restaurant criticism because I live in constant paranoia of being overlooked, forgotten, or whatever. And so, you know, the notebook thing really. Can I use words like pisses me off? Really does.
Yeah.
Really,
what about really farmer names? Local, this from this farm, this provenance, this syrup came from this business.
It can be exhausting. And it can also look like grandstanding. If you make a simple statement somewhere that you care about your suppliers, that'll do. If you're about to start naming specific farmers. I kind of want to know why. I'm much in the dishes. The dish names get longer and longer and longer. I'd prefer if you want to do a roll call of your suppliers at the end of the menu somewhere, fine, that's nice. Mm-hmm. But if you start throwing them in to every dish name and you're wearing your heart on your sleeve, then I find that somewhat, you know, tiresome.
Yeah.
I also think, you know, quality ingredients is a minimum qualifying standard, isn't it?
Well, you're talking to two people who run Heritage Foods. So, I mean, we think that probably 90% of the restaurants are using what we call commodity, the lowest common denominator of the cheapest food available, no matter where it comes from, especially with livestock, is where it's, it becomes an inhumane issue, not just a health issue. We wish that there'd be fewer restaurants, but they would buy better ingredients. And in the case of meat, that meat would cost more. I mean, we do realize
that. Oh, well, yeah, well, I think meat should cost more. It's an issue I've written about many, many times.
Well, yeah, and you said you have a book in the past on sustainability,
so I wrote
correct?
A book called Greedy Man in a Hungry World, and it was looking, it's 2013, still available, and it was looking at genuine definitions of sustainability, because the what I love is that we are actually sitting in a restaurant. Every now and then you can hear service dropping cutlery.
Thank God they're not playing the radio.
Oh, yeah. Because your foodie middle classes will cling to certain totems. It's got to be small scale, it's got to be local, it's got to be seasonal, it's got to be organic. All of those things have a narrative quality to them that is beguiling and in places has value to it. But if you are going to look at true definitions of carbon sustainability, it is much, much more complicated than that. For example, you know, once I finally started researching this stuff, I realized that to understand the carbon footprint of your food, you need to look at the whole life cycle and analyze that whole carbon life cycle. And if you do that, you discover that the transport of the food accounts for between 2 and 3% of the carbon footprint. What matters is how your food is produced, not where. And the example I often give is...
Here it is. That was a chapter in my book.
Yeah.
Fuck local, eat the best.
Yeah, well, it's... yeah.
I didn't really mean that meanly.
But one of the examples I give is that there's a great potato production area in the east of England, in Lincolnshire. And that's where we produce potatoes. If you produce it there, you'll get 20 tons an acre. If you look at London, the London Basin... very few potatoes produced there, and people go, but we're locavores, why are we producing it in the... Well, because it's clay, and if you produce your potatoes there, you're going to get 16 tonnes an acre. Mm-hmm. So now, suddenly, you need either 25% more land or shed loads of carbon inputs to produce the same yield. Mm-hmm.
There's certain places that make peaches here at the farmer's market. I'm like, leave that to Georgia, please, or the Ojai, California. Yeah. They're so much better.
I mean, it gets really extreme, and this is where it gets really interesting when you're talking about, so in the UK, some of our top fruit and our tomatoes and so forth will come from Morocco. And people go, but this is a terrible, terrible way to produce tomatoes. You go, well, is it? Have a look at the carbon inputs required to get a successful tomato in the mediocre summer of England,
right,
compared to one produced at a low carbon input in Morocco, even with the transport.
I like that his far away is actually local to anyone in the U.S.
Well, that's
because he's like 3 hours.
A very interesting point, but yeah. So, well, Morocco is four hours flight from London.
Okay.
What really matters then, you have to get into transport as well. Sorry, I can bang on about this for a very, very long time.
No, we want to bang. We want to bang, baby.
But anyway, that's a 2013 book. That's why I'm hesitating.
Well, so we
want
to talk a little bit about your new book, Jay Rayner's Last Supper. You have a chapter about sparkling water and a chapter about snails.
I do.
We love those ideas. Those
Patrick feels strongly about sparkling
water. So tell us, what
are
in those chapters? Why did you choose those two chapters?
I'll tell you that I chose all the chapter headings, and it goes through a bunch of things, snails, oysters, bread and butter, blah, 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 because of the emotional connection. So this book came from the fact that when I do my live one-man shows, I have long been asked, imagine you're on death row, what would your last meal be? And I've always said, if I was on death row, I think I'd have lost my appetite. And I got thinking about all the people who are eligible, the condemned, the terminally ill, the suicidal, not a happy crowd. None of them are suited to eating this last meal, but what you're really being asked is, if there was nobody watching, if you didn't have to care about consequence, and you put together a meal that redefined who you are, what would you have? And so when I came to the chapter headings, they needed to be foods to which I had an emotional connection through story. So, for example, there was a chapter heading cheese, and then I realised I didn't have much to say, really. I love cheese, but it's not going to end up there because it's not got that emotional heft.
So what happened with you and the champagne of water? Tell us.
Sparkling water and me and going through many of these sort of interesting realizations that your habits are appalling. Appalling. I had this appalling 16-liter a week habit, and they were all coming in plastic bottles. It was shameful. I would kind of try and sneak to the recycling bin to get the plastic bottles in without anybody seeing. You know, that chapter opens with me describing what sounds like I've got a terrible, terrible booze habit. And then I finally found my way through, you know, one of the home carbonation devices.
Yes.
But I also, you know, I think it's an interesting subject around taste and the things, the sensations that we enjoy. I went and found my way to a self-described water sommelier who, you know, could lead me down the path of greatness.
Did he lead you back to tap water?
No, he thinks, what was his line, that tap water is just filtered piss. And I went, yeah, whatever. I did. I mean, you know, I'll give one thing away. I held the Last Supper at the end. And for that, I went and bought two cases of the most expensive sparkling water there is. It's a thing called
Voss.
No, it's Châteaudun.
Oh, okay.
Châteaudun was Louis XIV's favourite water. It's a natural.
So it's a spring near Versailles?
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't know what. You can find it on some menus in ridiculous sort of Russian oligarch restaurants for like 10 quid. It's ludicrous, but I bought two cases for £70. What's that? 90 bucks?
Yeah.
You had to do the last meal right.
And so it was there. And what's interesting, when I came to write this, I realized I paid no attention to that element of the last meal. It had just sat there and nobody was going, oh, sparkling water, fine. which is quite funny. I mean, the whole chapter is also about my control issues around booze. And actually, in that chapter, I go into some detail about my involvement with Mario Batali and how I tried to avoid having a monstrous night with him by not matching him drink for drink and all that sort of stuff. And
so you brought in the sparkling water.
And sparkling water became my friend that night.
Yeah. It still feels like you're not drinking water a little bit.
That's the point.
Yeah.
You know, as a
grown-up. And if you add a lime to it, you maybe feel like you have a
spritz of lemon juice and you're away.
Yeah, Roberta's gave me a seltzer recently with a orange peel.
We always notice that we always order sparkling, Anne and I just love it, but we notice that it actually maybe gets us even better service at certain restaurants because they're like, oh, for a mere $4 or $6, you get that. I love sparkling water.
It has to be said. That there is a much less developed sparkling water culture in the US than in the UK. It's pretty much down to like two or three brands that you'll ever find in restaurants here.
Well, here it's still... Yeah. San Pellegrino is... Perrier is not as big as it used to be. It used to be the only game in town, the green bottle with the yellow writing.
I mean, that's pretty much it
in
a restaurant. Whereas in the UK...
Yeah, what is it? The Larissa? There's one
that I've seen from the Ozarks that Vinegar Hill has. It's got like a little creek on it.
But the US has done is also that they're moving to... in a more sustainable way.
And that's
there's a filtration
the
system, yeah. And it's like a tap at the
and
bar.
And that's what I have. That's free. What I have.
Either
at home
one is
now.
Free.
I have a,
not you know. Always free. They still charge you
Dave
for it.
Dave Arnold, who's a chef on a scientist on this show, network with, what's his name of his show? Oh my God.
Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues. Is an actual master of sparkling water and puts even more carbonation through his filtration system. Very, very interesting. Why snails?
I love the theater. I love the accessories.
You mean the little fork?
If it's done properly, they have to be served in the shell. A snail not served in a shell is a waste of your time. So it has to.
It dries out, right?
No, it's not just that. I mean, it does slightly. There are ways to get around that. But it needs to be there because you need to remove them from the shell. So you've got the tongs.
You're
as
talking
well.
About in the plate with the crevices in it, and it's
yeah, and,
that
there, and there's your
oil.
Shell, and there's and so there's that. So the ideal, the platonic ideal of snail eating, is with a paraffin flame underneath a burner plate, so that the butter is starting to spread, and you can fry your bread in it,
yes.
And then you've got the tongs. And you need to know that once you've got the snail into the ball of the tong at the end, you've got to keep your wrist loose because if you squeeze as you're putting the fork in, the snail will fly across the room. This is stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is technique. And
this is theater too.
As a seven-year-old, that was where I was introduced to them. I had a very privileged childhood. I'm sodden with privilege. People would say to me, you know, back in the day, they don't say it anymore. Check your privilege. I mean, I've checked. I've got loads. It's great.
I've checked it and I still have some.
Yeah, I've checked it and I'm absolutely fine. I just always loved that theatre. I mean, the fact I also love the flavour and the taste and the experience, but there was something compelling, utterly compelling, and in the moment of it. And it takes me back to that sense of my childhood with my parents, who were working class kids, made good, old East End Jews who'd done very well for themselves and did not want to visit their privations on their kids. And so we were introduced to some very lovely things. And that's part of it.
We knew that's why we were going to like you. You're Jewish.
Well, the three Jews, two who sell pork. Well, the snail was the mascot of Slow Food, which is an organization, a very cosmopolitan animal. I've added that to my Last Supper. We're always asking people what their Last Supper would be. Carne cruda for me with the oil, not the steak tartare. Peking duck with the scallions and that hoisin sauce. And, of course, a bagel with cream cheese and wild salmon and capers and a lot of onions. And those would be big parts
He's
of my
having,
last.
He's having some conflicts, internal conflicts. I don't know that all of his Last Supper dishes complement each other.
I'll They're say just... the more...
No, but they shouldn't.
They don't need to?
Right in the beginning of my book, I say, you know, as a restaurant critic for The Observer, I am judging a meal based on a search for poise and balance and perhaps something edging towards perfection. But actually, if I got my last meal right, or depending on your point of view, wrong, it would be a bloody mess. It would be a cacophonous...
For the mortician who has to deal with your insides 24 hours later?
Possibly. It would be this collection of ludicrous dishes which apparently would, to those of us of refined taste, would have nothing to say to each other, but they would have everything to say to you. I got an interesting question. I just did a Q&A thing with the LA Times, and the journalist said, you know, there is no foie gras, there is no Chateaubriand, there's no, you know, these grand ingredients. Why not? And I said, because they're so self-satisfied. In any meal with those luxury things on the table, it's always look at me, look at me, look at me. And there's no space in there for your own memory to get in. It can sometimes be very humble. One of the best responses I had, because I asked people for this, was from a chap in Britain who said he would go and knock on the door of the house where his grandmother once lived, his late grandmother lived, and ask if he could sit on the back step where he would then eat a Dairylea cheese triangle. This is one of the most pappy processed cheeses you can get in the UK.
For us, it's like a slice of Velveeta.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And it's the beautiful image of a grown man remembering a time of being loved and feeling utterly secure.
Yeah, it's memories, it's emotions. I mean, Patrick's was a little, you know, on the fancier side over here.
I think that tells us everything we need to know about Patrick.
Well, no, England has all this baggage. Europe has all the 500 years of baggage. They look at a bottle and it's all, you know, in America we're much fresher. We don't have as much cultural baggage. We're a little... less,
you
troubled.
Have plenty of cultural baggage. The great myth of the young nation without
its culture.
We're
still
teenagers. We're still teenagers.
While our skin is still
supple. While you were developing
supple.
Printing, we were raping the Native Americans. No, it doesn't.
I'm serious. It's okay. We are over the fact that you owned us once. We are no hard feelings. But can you talk to us?
It was a terrible investment. We were delighted to get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you, critic, speaking of the two nations across the pond, critic in the US, restaurant critic versus in England. Are there differences?
Well, there are. And I think the key thing is that, and this applies to a lot of American broadsheet journalism, is a great seriousness and sense of propriety. Now, we are also very responsible and have a sense of seriousness in the broadsheet end. I'm not going to comment on the tabloid end of the British press, which is, you know, full of rats trying to chew each other's tails off. But in the broadsheet end, we do take it seriously, but there is nothing more serious than a conviction American broadsheet journalist. And it is often an utter culture shock when we get to write for American publications.
Do you mean, like a certain civic duty that
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I want to emphasize that it's not like we don't give a toss. We do. But there is this very formal sense about American broadsheet newspaper high culture journalism, which can be startling to the British journalists.
Why is it? Why is it? Is it because there's many cultures here and you're mostly only one culture, so you can be more...
Well,
less civic-minded? No, but I mean more.
Well, you know...
Most people in England are English. most people here are not.
Well, thinking of London, I mean,
if you think about
one generation away from 1,000 different cultures in this country, we're a melting pot country. Well, England, I don't know.
No, we are much more similar. Okay. Than you would think.
Particularly, at least in London.
Yeah, particularly the urban areas that newspaper journalism comes out of. So I don't think it's anything to do with that. There's always been a suspicion that American newspaper journalists are really limbering up to write the great American novel. And they're waiting to be spotted by literary agents all over Manhattan and someone to sidle up to them and say, I really think it's time you put aside these childish things.
Like Walt Whitman. He was a newspaper writer.
Yeah, and Tom Wolfe and all of that. And but also there's a British tradition going back to Chaucer through Boswell and Pepys of a ribald speaking truth to power in a filthy-minded way. I mean, I put lines in my reviews that would never get anywhere near an American newspaper.
An editor would cut it. You said an editor wouldn't like it.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I'll give you. I described the service. Actually, this is relevant to where we are because the restaurant is a London offshoot of a Brooklyn business, which is Maison Premier.
Sure.
Seafood. So they have opened a terrible restaurant called Seabird in a rooftop on the Hoxton Hotel, which was just dismal in every single way. And the service was appalling. You know, food arrives before they manage to get our wine on the table. Waiter does refuse to take an order with a notebook, then forgets one of the dishes. The dishes are grossly overpriced. They're quite nice, some of the food, but you are left with this jangling. Anyway, I described the service as having all the, you know, the pleasure of an unlubricated colonoscopy. And
I read that line.
And, oh, wow. And it got a lot of love from the readers, but I know that had I, in some alternative universe, written that for an American publication, the blue pencil would have come out. It would have gone.
I love what you said about Chaucer and kind of saying fuck you to power. I mean, also, I believe their sitcoms are a lot more biting and insightful.
Well, now here's an interesting thing. There is an episode of Conan O'Brien's podcast.
Yes.
Conan O'Brien wants to make some friends, where he interviews John Oliver and O'Brien says, and you've got all the best the best sitcoms. And John Oliver, you know, British comedian, says quite rightly, he says, no, you see, the thing is you only got the good 2%. There's a lot of shit. There's a lot of terrible, terrible British sitcoms.
Not everything is A Man Are Born see. Or Are You Being Charged? Or
Are You Being Served?
Served, yeah.
Is that one of the classics of British sitcom?
No, but I grew up watching it. Well, Fawlty Towers for sure.
All right, Fawlty Towers.
1,000%.
Blackadder and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I think we really have to just be grateful for Downton Abbey, no? And not a sitcom.
Is that that's English?
Yeah.
Downton Abbey? Christ, is it ever.
No, I didn't know if the people who made it were Hollywood.
Very, very British.
BBC.
Although basically Downton Abbey is a soap opera, like, I don't know what the example is, like General Hospital in Bustles. That's what it is. You can practically hear that, you know, there's always a cliffhanger at the end of, and Lady Mary, where's Lady? She's fallen down the stairs.
Yeah. wait for next week.
Well, exactly. Tell us about food television. You're on it here, or it's become a real thing. I mean, there's...
I have a general view on food television. People often seem to get very aerated about food television as in some way letting down the food culture. And my response to that is, some people cook some stuff and nobody dies. And I mean it. I mean, you know, there are worse things in the world to get upset by. And I tend to find that the audience is a great tastemaker in this. So MasterChef is the UK show that I'm involved in. I only actually work on it 5 days a year, but it's enough to maintain a career on television.
Great.
And people enjoy watching other people cook. Every now and then a new format appears, and it runs for one series because it's awful, and the punters don't want it, the viewers don't want it.
So I think the two that seem to work, correct me if I'm wrong, are the competition show, and now we're into this artsy, highly produced chef's table, you know, beauty show. I don't know how to describe it.
I mean, Chef's Table, I think Chef's Table is hilarious and is posited on a lie. Can I be my controversial self? So, Chef's Table every single chef has to have an origin story. You know, like Spider-Man gets bitten by a spider and whatever. So on Chef's Table, they all have to, you know, was it Massimo Bottura? I was lying under the table as a child and my grandmother was rolling tortellini off the side. Or Dan Barber, one day I only had asparagus and so I had to cook with asparagus. And the real problem...
and that woe made is me.
Yeah. And the real problem with it is that many chefs go into being chefs not as an alternative to a career in vaudeville. It's not because they could have been an entertainer.
Yeah.
They're actually, and it's not criticism, you know, we need different jobs for different people. They found something rather pleasing about the quiet solitude of being in a kitchen, of being cloistered in there. I don't know about you, but every time I've spoken to chefs, almost all of them have some story about, I looked into the kitchen and I saw a world in which I belonged.
Yeah, they're pirates on ships. They live on ships.
Well, the pirate thing, we'll come back to that. But here's the issue. For Chef's Table to work, the character has to have a personality. And not many of them do. So I think the one that really got me was one of the first series of Chef's Table. It was a brilliant Japanese lady in Los Angeles, and I've forgotten her name, but about 10 minutes into this hour-long documentary, she utters the immortal phrase, I just really want my food to speak for me. To which I thought, that's fine, but what the fuck are we going to be watching for the next 50 minutes? And it did go on a bit like that. And then it leads others to, you know, Dan Barber going on about how he only gets to see his daughter one day a week, but if that's what it takes. Stop it. Go and see your child. I mean, you're only making dinner for rich people. All you're doing is preparing $250 tasting menus.
Else had something strange with their child was Francis Malman. He was the weird one.
He cooked his child.
It's escaping me, but he had a strange relationship with his child as well, because he would go out into the hills and be away, and yes, exactly.
Look, be a parent, because honestly, plutocrats from the Upper East Side will survive without your tasting menu if they can't get to it because you're not there to cook it.
So now I want to know about English food. I understand that you guys have a chip on your shoulder and need to say, "Oh, London is the most advanced country." But
we get really tired of people who haven't been to Britain enough to eat going, "Oh, the food's shit."
No, I know, but there is a stereotype that English food traditionally was bad. Like France, very good. Italy, very good. Is that true? And has it changed? But I'm not talking about
the first thing I have to say is, Have you stopped at a truck stop in Idaho?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
And ordered lunch.
No, we try to avoid. But by the way,
look,
admit that the state of American food is not that good. Right. So in England, I'm wondering what is it. I mean, I think
when you say England, can we say Britain, please? So can we bring Scotland and Wales and Northern? In fact, go United Kingdom, bring Northern Ireland into it.
But I'm saying, why that stereotype?
I'll tell you, we lost a generation of cooks because from 1939 to 1945,
the war.
We fought a war of national survival. We nationalized food production. We reduced the availability of ingredients to rations. We had a Presbyterian puritanical response to food at a time of privation, which made any kind of indulgence in it feel in some way obscene.
It's very interesting.
And we lost a generation of cooks. So it took until about the 1970s. So there'd been stirrings in the late 50s and early 60s with, you know, Elizabeth David going on her travels and being an utter snob, and various restaurants opening in the West Country. But things found their way back. But one of the hilarious things...
We lost a generation, too, if we even ever had one, with fast food. Everybody loved it. They were catering weddings with McDonald's. It was a phenomenon, the technology. You know, the future is used machines.
The people who probably wanted to cook went to France. They went to Spain. They left.
There is no doubt that food culture in the UK has improved massively. It's sometimes misunderstood. And there was a very good piece about Fergus Henderson of the saintly Fergus Henderson of St. John.
In the Times.
And I was interviewed for that. And one of the points I made in that was, one of the great myths is that what St. John did was rediscovered the food of our great-grandparents. It didn't. Our great-grandparents never ate as well as the food that's cooked at St. John. But what he did do was look at some of those dishes from back in the day and engineer them through the sensibility of a cosmopolitan man who'd grown up in London and gone on his holidays in France.
So are there a few really key players that are bringing back or making it the best it's ever been? British.
One of the great things about British Britain, food-wise, and it speaks to your point about America being a melting pot, is that because our own food culture was stunted for a very long while, we have always been a hell of a lot more open. So one of the classic, you know, things that would be said by the foodie middle classes in Britain in the 80s and 90s was, oh, France is so marvellous, they had this robust food culture. But what they wouldn't quite admit was that if you went to the Dordogne for 2 weeks' holiday, on the first day, confit de canard and a tartatin, marvellous. On the second day, steak frites and a tartatin. Day three, confit. What they wouldn't do by day four for a Thai green curry. And and it's absolutely true. So this homogeneity of food can be brilliant in France, or, you know, go to Tuscany in Italy, or you go to Catalonia and you'll find these great dishes. If you spend any time there hunting around, every menu is the same.
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, yes, we have, one of the things we've had is this St. Johnification of food, which looks back to all these old dishes and does it very well. But the other thing is that we are open to many, many other things. Mm-hmm. Partly that is the legacy of colonialism. If you rape and pillage a country, you often bring back its recipes. So we have, you know, one of the things that I think we have to accept is there is very little great food from the Indian subcontinent in New York, but there's loads of it in London.
Yeah.
Loads of it from a variety of regions. We are fully regionalized.
Well, I'm going in May, and my husband said to me, why are we, why? He said this two nights ago. He's like, you don't really go for that much Indian food or Sri Lankan food in New York. He's like, why are we going to go to London and that's what you're searching for? Well, and I'm like, because that's, because that's sense. What I'm supposed yeah. to now, go and how, eat in London.
What would you recommend to Emily? I'm also going with my three kids to London for 3-4 days. How do you recommend that a tourist tackle the cuisine? What's the right way to go? To read your reviews and see things you've given stars to?
Read my
to?
Reviews. Go on to Eater London, which does a very nice job of finding the smaller places.
So can you give us an example of how many do you give out stars? I mean, how many top ratings
I don't
give
out
given?
Stars because...
well, top ratings.
If you give out stars out of 5, most restaurants would be a 2 or a 3, and readers would look at that 2 or 3 and go, oh, I don't need to read this piece. And I want them to read my glittering prose, however
you don't want
them
to also scan
so
to
no
the bottom
whatsoever.
Not by me, okay. Some of them did, but not by me. I need you to read my joyous linguistic gymnastics.
We like to, I guess, you know, my goal would be to go to England to eat at a great without the top restaurant, a great pub type restaurant, and they're great. You know, we're also going to Stonehenge. I mean, can you eat good out there?
Yeah, we'll do a bit of research and you'll probably find somewhere.
Okay.
And rest your hand on the stones. Probably. But,
and get
the
some
gastro
disease.
Pub. The gastro
How many people
pub
have touched
scene.
It? Those rocks.
The gastro pub scene has created a more reliable source of food across Britain. But the gastro pub menu. The British gastropub menu will now look something like this. It'll be a goat's cheese and beetroot salad, a terrine and a risotto to start, a ribeye, a pork belly or a sea bass dish for mains, a lemon tart, a creme brulee and a chocolate fondant.
No shepherd's pies?
Not necessarily, yeah. No. I mean, I can direct you to places for that stuff if that's what you're after. Really good. Go to Rules, go to Simpsons, go to the Game Bird, or do go to one of those St. John-esque restaurants like Rochelle Canteen or Rochelle Canteen at the ICA. There are lots of them.
It's funny, in the U.S. when I would travel with Anne to weird places, the microbrewery culture have excellently sourced ingredients at their restaurants. Even though it's just burgers and a chicken sandwich, you actually are guaranteed to the microbrewery
scene.
But
I suspect that they're going down the block and getting local from their neighbors
who
make
sense.
Cheese.
Microbrewery, micro-thinking. Anyway.
We have to take a very quick break and we'll be back with a little bit more of Jay Rayner.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. Founded by Shuichi Kotani, Worldwide Soba offers noodle consulting services in addition to supplying a variety of tools for wannabe noodle makers. Want to take a class? Worldwide Soba has it. Need a traditional Japanese soba knife? Worldwide Soba has that too. To learn more, visit worldwide-soba.com.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are here with Jay Rayner, the restaurant critic from The Observer. We've been having a lot of fun. Jay, we were just talking about visiting London and where Patrick and I need to go when we're there. But dare I ask you about your meals in New York this week? Yeah. Have you had any exceptional bites or dishes terrible?
No. I've actually eaten rather better this time than I have in the past. I'm not sure why that is. I can tell you exactly where I've been. I have a kind of jet lag therapy booking every time I arrive. I went to Union Square Cafe because that's great.
Love it.
Does it very, very nicely. I went to Red Rooster in Harlem for brunch because, nice. You know, I have this interest in jazz. I went to King. After, I forget Jess's surname, but King on King Street.
And Claire and Jess, I believe, with their names.
Yeah. And that was great. I recorded an episode of my podcast called Out to Lunch, in which I take interesting people out to a great restaurant, and we went to Crown Shy for that. And James Kent's way with chicken is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
How do you like the foot?
I think the foot's a lovely detail. I didn't quite actually pick it up and go for it. I should have done, but I was juggling doing the interview as well. So,
Who do you take out to lunch? Are we allowed to know?
Oh, yeah. Well, it won't mean much, I have to say, to an American audience in this case. So it's a British stand-up comedian, a very well-known British stand-up comedian called Ramesh Ranganathan. He's of Sri Lankan descent. But he was, funnily enough, he was doing his shows, his first New York shows at the Soho Playhouse, where I did mine.
Yeah.
So it was kind of fun to catch him at this moment before he went live. So, yeah, I've eaten very, very well. And I go straight from here to Russ and Daughters because it's the law.
Which one?
The Cafe on Orchard.
They opened in Brooklyn Naval Yards, which is a neighborhood in New York. By the way, we're big fans of the, what is the cheese company that Anne works with in London?
Neil's Yard.
Neil's Yard, their whole redevelopment of that neighborhood. You know, where all those public markets are.
Oh, a borough. Yeah. They didn't quite do that, but they were there, and they are
early
there.
On.
Yeah. Neil's Yard is a great business, and stocks some brilliant cheeses. Mm-hmm. And they are one of those companies that I think can be pointed out and said, yes, they are part of whatever the British resurgence or renaissance in food has been.
And Brexit, does that mean anything to the restaurant scene, the ability to get food? What are the things that you worry about?
I've only just clocked that, as well as this being available as a podcast, it's out live, so I'll try and keep my swearing.
Go for it.
Can I? It's a fucking disaster. Apart from being inward-looking and inbred and kind of pathetic failure to engage with the world, it is a disaster. The lack of freedom of movement is going to have a massive impact on the people who work in our country. It's going to have massive impact on food supply. The European Union is not without its faults. There is no such thing as a perfect political enterprise. But the way it made food from all over available at a fine price and brought in some very significant environmental laws is very, very important. And I don't want to tar a country with one brush because obviously there's diversity. But we live in fear of an American trade deal which drops restrictions on chlorine-washed chicken and growth and hormone-boosted beef, which for various reasons have not been available in the EU for a very long time. And it seems like we're pretty clear that to get whatever trade deal they need, the British government, as currently configured, will happily go, yeah, bring it in.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy. Good answer. We should have asked that earlier in the show.
But it would have depressed everybody.
Yeah, good.
No, we had to focus.
Only 20% of this show is about depressing things. The other 80% is positive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so we highly recommend everyone grab a copy of Jay Rayner's Last Supper. One meal, a lifetime in the making. But
it's like a lubricated colonoscopy. It's lovely. Yes, it's cleansing.
It's smooth, and at the end you'll feel better about yourself. And yes. How far can we take this metaphor? Go on.
Yeah. Well, I just want, since Patrick and I do sell 200 heritage breed pigs a week at Heritage Foods, and you have an entire chapter called Pig. I do have to ask, do you have a favorite cut of pork or a favorite preparation?
A favorite breed.
Okay, and a favorite breed.
Get over yourself. That's your thing. Yeah. So I'm not going to reveal what the final item that I chose in the book is. I am very partial to pork belly. But I mean, it's got to be in the full slab and then roasted high, top heat, for about 20 minutes to crackle. And the skin has to be very, you know, absolutely dry. And then low and slow for the next 4 hours.
And then, do you cook?
Yeah,
do you like to cook?
Yeah, yeah. There are recipes in the book.
I know, I saw that. But well, I didn't know if you truly enjoy it or if to leave it in the hands.
Cooking
of...
is my... I can't eat out in restaurants all the time, so I need, you know, I need to go somewhere else.
I hope this is one of your favorite two or three favorite podcasts of the day.
Oh, it's... I think of all the podcasts I've done this morning, this is the best.
Good.
Fantastic. We're happy. Jay, thanks so much for joining us, and safe travels back to the UK. We look forward to... Maybe you'll take us out to lunch when we come to visit.
I'm going to sign up to your... I want to get online to read the restaurant reviews. I mean, that's exciting. We should have our finger on the pulse
free,
of food.
They're free to find. If you want to find any of my stuff, I have a website, jrayner.co.uk.
That's what I'm going to read before going to England.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Jay.
Thank you.
The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.